You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 8th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Okay, four birthdays of note this day.
We have
Otto Heinrich Warburg. We also have Robert Porter. We have Jens Christian Sekou. And we have Caesar Milstein.
I don't know any of this. Are those just your neighbors?
All Nobel laureates.
Oh, okay.
In sciences over the years.
Wow.
All of them have birthdays today. Today.
Wow.
Great. Well, they're all dead. They're all dead, too. But besides the
they're,
point, they were all
born Libras, on this day. Which, you know, Libras are well known as being the smartest,
science-y
skeptical types
in
the world. I'm just saying. Did I mention my birthdays next week?
Yes, you did.
You did. Okay. But you didn't win a Nobel Prize. But
yet.
We'll forgive you.
I remember last year you making a big deal about your birthday. Is it still a big deal?
It's always a big deal, my friend. Always.
It is.
Okay.
This year we're going to be bar hopping in Central Square if anybody wants to come along.
Speaking of the Nobel Prize, some of the 2008 Nobel Prizes have been announced over the last week. A few very interesting ones. The Nobel Prize for Chemistry was given out to three scientists, Osamu Shimomura, Martin Chalfie, and Roger Tsen, for the discovery and development of the green fluorescent protein, or the GFP.
So cool. Do you know what they can do with that thing? Apparently, all right, I don't know anything, but apparently they can identify a certain type of cell and make this thing cling onto it and light it up so that they can identify it in a whole body. Is that right?
It's better than that. Better than identifying a cell, they can label proteins and see where those proteins go within a cell three-dimensionally. This is one of those pieces of biological technology that doesn't translate directly into anything useful for people, but what it translates into is improved research technology itself. So it increases the rate at which we can do scientific research. And those things always have a tremendous effect on science, although they're usually not something that the public would know a lot about. And this is one of those things. What these guys did is isolated this gene from a jellyfish, and they've discovered that it can retain its property, meaning that it fluoresces green, even if you attach it. This is what's really cool. Even if you attach it to another gene. So they can splice this with another gene, and then that combined gene will make the fluorescent protein and whatever other protein it makes, so that you can track that other protein wherever it goes and create a three-dimensional model of it inside the cell. And this has given us, plus combined with, you know, improved microscopy and improved computer and information handling technology, combination of technologies has really accelerated the pace of understanding how cells work and where things go and everything. It's really had far-reaching, tremendous effects on biology.
And one day this technology could be used to make glow-in-the-dark shoelaces.
One day. We can always hope. We can always hope.
And Elvis posters.
Very cool stuff. The 2008 Nobel Prize in Physics goes to three people also: Yoichiro Nambu, Makoto Kobayashi, and Toshihide Maskawa, for discoveries concerning nature's broken symmetry.
Which is apparently like your ticket to the Nobel Prize if you are going into physics and you just want to be guaranteed a Nobel Prize. You should study symmetry. That's what I found out. Because seriously, like in the last, 30 years or something, there have been about 3,000 Nobel Prizes for symmetry research. I made that number up, but there have been a lot.
Interestingly, like in the first half of the century, there were lots of Nobel Prizes given for people who were discovering symmetry, and now we're giving prizes for people who are discovering where that symmetry is broken.
It's really interesting. I've been reading a lot about it because it just blows my mind. It's one of those topics that's just beyond my mental capabilities, I think. but it seems pretty cool. And
very cool.
You know, just to give like small background information to people, like what they're talking about with symmetry is kind of like in the beginning after the Big Bang, there's a serious question as to how we ended up with all this matter in the universe and no antimatter hanging around, when presumably there were equal parts of both at the beginning. There was some kind of symmetry at first, and that symmetry was broken in favor of matter. And if it hadn't have been broken, then none of us would be here today.
Yeah, Bob and I, we talked about that a few weeks ago. And one factoid I picked up in reading about this prize was that the ratio of the original matter and antimatter to the residue of matter was 10 billion to 1. That means that at the Big Bang, our universe was initially 10 billion times bigger or more massive or whatever than it is now. And that this matter that's left over, everything that compromised the universe is just this little residue that was left over. There's one part in 10 billion left over.
We've been talking so much about symmetry and throwing around that word. I think we should go into a little bit of background of what it means and why it's such an important concept in physics. And this is because it describes how things are the same even after some fundamental changes occur to them. And there's three types of symmetry. There's time, mirror or parity, and charge symmetries. Time symmetry means that physical processes appear the same even after time flows backwards. So you imagine a movie with billiard balls hitting each other. It makes sense if the film is going forwards or backwards. That's time symmetry. Mirror or parity symmetry means that the particles behave the same if you compare them to the same particle in a mirror universe of sorts, like if you held up the letter A to a conventional mirror in your house, how it would be identical. And then there's charge symmetry, the last one, and that says that particles behave the same if their charge is reversed as long as the other properties are the same. And this is the symmetry that was broken, that Rebecca was talking about, that occurred after the Big Bang. And it's a good thing that symmetry did break, because otherwise the universe would be a little bit different than it is right now. We'd probably just be an expanding shell of energy, and there'd be no matter, there'd be no particles, there'd be, I don't know about dark energy, there probably would be dark energy.
Be awfully boring.
But very boring and probably lifeless.
Nothing would be on TV.
Probably a lifeless place.
There'd be no podcasts.
Or maybe there'd be energy beings.
Yeah, traveling at the speed of light.
Right.
Yeah.
And one of the cool things is that there's such a thing as hidden symmetries, which is a lot of what this research is about. One of the ways I heard it described is if you picture a sombrero, and if you're on the very top of the sombrero and it's spinning around, everything looks pretty much the same. Your surroundings always look exactly the same. So it may appear perfectly symmetrical. But if you were to go down into the brim of the hat and you're rolling around every which way there, your scenery would clearly be changing. And you could see that there's... That the symmetry isn't quite what you thought it was. So much of the idea is, you know, we need to figure out how to break the symmetry by kind of shoving your perspective off of the top of the sombrero into the brim, and then we can kind of see the differences between things that otherwise looked identical.
Bob, these gentlemen have been working in their field since the 60s, working on this research. It's taken a long time.
Absolutely.
For them to have achieved this, and I guess it took this long for their experiments and their science,
right,
to be recognized, replicated, and anything else that needs to be done before the prize was ever awarded to them.
Well, the cool thing is that, you know, while they're, you know, the theoretical physicists are, you know, using mathematical formula, are trying to describe everything, they make assumptions about, well, maybe it all goes together this way, or maybe this is the equation. And those make predictions about particles that should exist. And then we can go to the particle colliders and smash stuff together and see if we could, you know, observe the particles that the theoretical physicists predicted should exist. And that's exactly what these guys did. They hypothesized that, you know, in their model, when you break the symmetries in the way that they discovered, that there should therefore be these other quarks, you know, that had not been previously known to exist, and those quarks were later, in fact, discovered. So that validated their mathematical, you know, model of putting things together. And that's essentially the way this has been progressing. You know, we have a standard model, then we see if those particles exist, and that valid. You know, every time we have a piece of the puzzle, then we could, you know, figure out the rest of the puzzle a little bit better, and then see if we could validate another piece and sort of grinding forward from there. That's why the LHC is so damn cool, because it's, you know, now we get to put more pieces of the puzzle together.
Yeah, and the thing is, reading about this stuff really drives home for me the point that has been made previously when the LHC was really in the news, and they were saying, yeah, it's going to be really exciting if we do find the Higgs boson, but what would be equally exciting is if we don't, because then that opens up this whole new world to explore. Like, well, if the Higgs boson doesn't exist, then where's all this matter coming from?
And Steve, you mentioned predicting particles and having that the prediction vindicated. Now, specifically, that's Kobayashi and Moskawa that made that prediction of a third family of quarks. They predicted that in 72, and it was discovered, I think, about 10 or 12 years ago. But you also mentioned the standard model, which is the standard model of physics is the integration of elementary particles, which is all matter except dark matter, and the strong, weak, and electromagnetic forces of nature, which of course excludes gravity. So it's a unification of these ideas, which is pretty much most of physics. I mean, the standard model is an amazing theory. Yeah. Now that ties back to the other Nobel Prize winner, Nambu. Now, because of his work with symmetry breaking, his work was the basis for a series of developments that led to the construction of the standard model itself. So this, according to Sheldon Glashow, who was a Nobel laureate for physics in 1979, he said that he really contributed to our understanding of physics in many domains. So it's an amazing contribution by Nambu as well as the other two guys.
So you're saying he deserves a Nobel Prize?
All three of these guys do. But we've been kind of focusing on Kobayashi, Moskawa, those two guys with the Big Bang and the quarks and stuff. But Nambu's contribution was distinct, but also you could argue even more fundamental.
The Nobel Prize for Medicine was given to three people also. I guess they decided that this year they all had to go to triplets.
Good things do come in threes. It's true.
One half of the award was shared by two French virologists, François Barré-Sanussi and Luc A. Montagnier, I think I got that right, for discovering the AIDS virus. HIV. And the other half was given to Dr. Harold Zurhausen for discovering the role of the human papillomavirus in cervical cancer. So given to virologists, it's a little odd, two sort of different discoveries, two different viruses, but they combined them this year. And I discussed in the Science Based Medicine blog about the HIV discovery, because I think that certainly that work is deserving of a Nobel Prize. And it really is a good example in our in recent history, our lifetime, some of us anyway, of the power of reductionist science. You know, that good old-fashioned, absolutely reductionist science, where you just break things down to their components and try to understand that at a fundamental level, has its place. It's extremely powerful. They correlated the virus with the AIDS, you know, the acquired immunodeficiency syndrome. It's a retrovirus. It infects immune cells. It takes out the immune system. This is how it works. It uses reverse transcriptase to turn RNA into DNA and insert it into the DNA of the host CD4 cells and replicate itself, and they sort of worked out the entire life cycle. And this led directly to, you know, the current therapy, which is the so-called highly active retroviral therapy, or HART, antiretroviral therapy, and which is, you know, extending the life expectancy of patients with HIV tremendously by decades. So it really is a triumph for, I think, the scientific approach to health and illness, and certainly deserving of a Nobel Prize.
Cool.
I'd like to throw out just like a random fact about Alfred Nobel and the
does this have to do with dynamite
and his past? Yeah, but you know, a lot of people know about it. Some people might not, and I found it very interesting when I first heard about it. He actually did invent dynamite, and the reason why he created the Nobel Prize was because he felt bad about creating dynamite, and that he wanted to basically give back to humanity something else that was worthy or honorable. Deadly. Yeah, not something that doesn't.
There's two more points to that, though. Didn't he actually read his own obituary? That was they thought he was dead, and it was like a relative, and he actually read his own obituary. And of course, the big thing he was noted for was the invention of dynamite, and that really upset
That's
him.
That's correct.
And ironically, when he invented it, he actually thought. Naively, in retrospect, of course, that it would end all wars because it was just too powerful, and you know people would realize that well we can't fight anymore because this stuff is just too powerful. So that adds a little more perspective to the situation.
Well, Nobel Prize are always interesting to talk about every year. It's very cool. Of course, there were some non-science ones. They're coming out, I think, in the coming week.
Who cares?
But yeah, but we're a science podcast, so so here's a trivia question: what Nobel laureate was interviewed on the SGU?
Carter?
Jimmy Carter. That's right.
Mark Crislip.
No, we also had Murray Gell-Mann on.
I don't think so.
Didn't we?
No, we never had him on.
No?
Nope.
Why didn't we have him on?
I don't know. We just never have.
Oh. You know what? I'm going to call him up and have him on.
Yeah, let's get him on. Maybe he'll explain the symmetry crap to us so we can understand it.
Oh, I have a trivia question.
Wink Martindale.
Ooh.
What's brown and sounds like radar? Poop. Poop.
Oh, nice. Good one.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
That's almost as bad as your what's brown and sticky
Rebecca's
joke.
Drinking contest is entered the second evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Anyway, this month is this year's installment of the Leibniz Prize, which has been around since 1995. It's an award for the first team to create a computer and software that can pass the Turing test. Now, in 1950, Alan Turing published a paper entitled Computing, Machinery, and Intelligence, a practical test to determine if a computer possesses true intelligence. And this has been known as the Turing test ever since. It essentially is you have a human examiner who interrogates or has a conversation with two entities. One is a live person. The other one is a computer program, you know, running software to simulate a conversation. And the machine will be said to pass the Turing test if it can fool the human or if the human can't tell the difference between the two. For the Leibniz Prize, I believe, in order to win the prize, you have to do it 30% of the time. You can't just get lucky once and have one stupid examiner and win the prize. You have to succeed 30% or more of the time. So there are the finalists are being tested this month, October, I think next week, in fact, October 12th. It'll be interesting to see how, you know, where that is. I wrote about this earlier in the week.
We're not close.
Yeah, we're not close. If you read the kind of conversations that the computers hold.
Yeah.
It's funny, it's when if you read like the transcript of the human conversation, you might think to yourself, is this a computer or a human? But when you read the computer, like, oh God, that's a computer.
Yeah.
You can tell it's not a person.
I've got an example right here, Steve. Just a few lines, and it's pretty obvious.
Should we have a dramatic reading where you do one and I'll do the other?
Surely. Hello, my name is Mike and I am a man.
Are you happy being a human?
Judge, I'm a guy.
Does that worry you?
Don't worry. We'll work everything through.
Do you have worries, then?
Let's move on from that basis. What the hell?
That sounds good. Let's move into the bedroom.
Oh, my God. Bob's the robot.
Now, granted, that was from Ultra Hal.
The
nice
chemical
name,
composition.
From last year. So hopefully Ultra Hal has been upgraded 10 or 20 times. But that was pretty lame. I would be utterly shocked. I would bet the house that no one's gonna get this year.
Yeah.
One way to deal with the fact that we need quite a bit of improvement before we can even think of passing a full blown Turing test. They would do the Turing test in limited domains so that you can only talk about one specific topic, and that's obviously a lot easier to do. The topic as they are now with the Leibniz test, it's total freeform. You could talk about anything you want, and that's just so hard. And one day I'm convinced we'll do it, but we're not there, and definitely not there.
Okay, here's what I don't get, though. But if you restrict it to one topic, then what you're doing is making it easier for a programmer to just account for every possible response that the computer might get, as opposed to the computer actually being able to, quote unquote, think for itself and respond in an appropriate manner, which to me is more the spirit of the Turing Prize.
Yeah, although the Turing test isn't really a test for artificial intelligence as the public, I think, colloquially understands that term, meaning that you have a computer that's conscious in the way that we're conscious.
I'm not suggesting that it should be conscious, though. I'm just suggesting that it should be able to react in a way that would then allow it to formulate the next response, as opposed to it scanning a sentence for certain keys, like the word, you know, worry and a question mark, and that brings up the response, I'm not worried, are you? Yeah.
So there's three levels here. There's three levels here, right? There's one level is a conversation algorithm, right, which is what you're talking about, where the computer doesn't understand anything. It's just going through some algorithm to decide what...
It's basically a parrot.
Yeah, what the next response should be. Maybe it has millions of phrases it can choose from. Or maybe it could even construct them out of fragments. But
that's what they call these systems now. For this Leibniz Prize this year, they're calling them artificial conversational entities.
Yeah, right. They're not really, you know, machine consciousness. It's just, it's a conversation algorithm. Or the next level is that the machine actually understands what words mean. It has some fund of knowledge, and then it can construct responses out of some abstract knowledge of facts about the world and understanding syntax and understanding language and having a vocabulary. But that a machine could do that without having consciousness also. And of course, then the third level would be a machine that actually has a human-like consciousness. The Turing test doesn't distinguish among those, because the Turing test is measuring only the output, and it treats the computer like a black box.
Right. And also, that's why I think that the spirit of the Turing test is to find at least that second or third option. And which is why I think the restricting the discussion to a single topic doesn't really help things.
No, it's not a real Turing test.
With enough time, you could program in whatever you want, you know.
Did you guys ever see that text? You can have a text sent to a friend where it's like a hot girl like talking to you, and it actually, for a little while, it can fool most people just by the way that they programmed it, like the kind of things that it says, like they predict like a lot of the common responses that people would have, and as the text goes on, it gets a little bit more obvious. But you know, you can go probably four or five exchanges with it without even thinking that it's just an automated type of thing.
I hear if you make it up to 10 responses without realizing it's a robot, they send you a free real doll.
Ooh.
So of course, this gets into the whole how would we know if it's really conscious thing. You know, what's the difference between a really sophisticated algorithm and true consciousness, and is human organic, you know, brain consciousness just a bunch of sophisticated algorithms itself? And our brains obviously can do a lot of processing, and actually most of the processing that it actually does is subconscious, right? So you could have a brain as powerful as our brain doing almost as much processing as our brain is doing, but not have any consciousness.
I hate when it happens.
But some parts of our brain are creating what we experience subjectively as consciousness. We're still kind of reverse engineering and figuring out what those pieces are and which ones are really critical and necessary for actual consciousness. But we don't really yet have a model for what consciousness actually is. We know what emerges out of brain function. We know that we're starting to figure out which pieces are important, but we don't really know, you know, how those pieces result in consciousness. What's different about them from those parts of the brain that could do lots of processing of information and remember stuff without being conscious, right? Like, you're not conscious of the processing that your brain does in order to create images out of the raw visual data. That's all completely subconscious. But it's a lot of brain processing that your brain does. You're just
to be aware of all that.
Yeah, crap. You don't want to be aware of it. It's not just that you're aware of it. It's not conscious. It's by definition subconscious. But here's the one thing. The point I made in my blog is that I don't think that there's any behavioral test like the Turing test that we could do to figure out if a machine is conscious or just a really sophisticated zombie. You know, just not conscious, but able to produce the output that makes it appear that it is. We would only know based upon our more basic understanding of how the machine itself is put together and works.
Right.
If it's put together to be conscious, then we could infer that it's conscious. If it doesn't have any consciousness module in it, then it probably isn't conscious. But here's the interesting thing is that what I think, and I think what a lot of other people think, is that we probably will achieve silicon consciousness, or you know, whatever passes for silicon in decades to come, by just simply duplicating the structure of the brain, even maybe before we fully understand it. In fact, that may be the pathway to our understanding. We build a virtual brain, and then we could see how it's working because we have a virtual model that we can examine, and we could turn off pathways and change them and see what the effect is. So understanding how the brain works and building artificial intelligence are two research pathways that are merging and playing off of each other in ways that I think are going to produce a lot of interesting results in the years to come.
Wouldn't that computer have to start doing things it was not initially – it was not at
like
all programmed
over humanity,
to do? It starts doing things spontaneously.
Kill John Connor.
Beyond its programming?
Yeah. I mean, its behavior and responses can't be canned. It would have to be
emergent.
Something emergent, something new. And I also, one other thing that I said is that it'd have to have the ability to have a conversation with itself, right? It has to have some kind of internal conversation going on as well, not just responding to external stimuli.
Should I kill all the humans or not kill all the humans? I don't know.
Well, let's go on to your questions and email. The first one is another correction. This one comes from Joe Walsh from Farmington, Connecticut. And Joe writes,
I blame
Rebecca's attribution of the quote last week, "The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference," to Darwin is incorrect, but is a common misattribution on the net. Richard Dawkins writes this sentence on page 133 of his 1995 book, River Out of Eden. "The searchable database at the Darwin online site has no match for Darwin writing this sentence anywhere." It does seem a little too harsh and nihilistic for Darwin, but not for his modern bulldog, Dawkins. Otherwise, a great podcast.
Joe, it was Rebecca, not my fault.
it was misattributed, and it was by the listener who submitted the quote, who probably just, as you say, pulled it off the net and didn't double check the attribution, which we didn't do because Rebecca was filling in at the last minute for Jay, who wasn't here.
Exactly. I was stepping in for Jay. It was not my fault.
Not that that's an excuse, but that's what
it's happened. Totally.
It's an explanation.
It's an excuse. I believe it absolves me of all responsibility.
We're a self-corrective kind of group.
There's a lot of misattributions on the net, and misattributions tend to
propagate,
migrate over to more famous people.
Oh yeah.
As Christopher Hitchens once said, Rebecca is always correct and is very humorous.
He did say that.
He did.
I thought Julia Sweeney said that.
Not.
Oh, well.
All right, let's do one real question. This one comes from Greg Kwan from Sydney, Australia. And Greg writes, "I love this podcast. I've gone back in time to catch up on the originals, and I've just listened to the one where Rebecca joined, a truly great addition to a working formula." Of course, he's writing this with an Australian accent, so you just have to imagine that. "Anyway, I'm not a scientist or a mathematician. However, I am absolutely fascinated by everything you guys do. I have four questions that I hope you can either answer or at least discuss."
Oh, boy.
The first question, why does light have a maximum speed?
That's a peculiar way to put it. And I have to really think about that. One answer, that the speed of light is a constant and we don't know why the constants are as they are. That's one of the big, big mysteries of physics, is where all the constants, how do you derive the constants? Well, another way to possibly look at it is that light has a maximum speed, and I assume what you mean, Greg, is that why doesn't it just keep going faster and faster? Why does it top out?
Well, what's odd, as you said, it's a little odd way of putting it. Light doesn't have a quote-unquote maximum speed. It has one speed.
Right.
It has one constant speed. Unless you're talking about light in different media.
Right.
And then you could say its maximum speed is its speed in a vacuum. But the speed of light in a vacuum is C. It's one constant speed. Regardless, and this is again Einstein's big contribution, regardless of your frame of reference.
I guess we have had some luck deriving the speed of light from other constants. such as the permittivity of free space and the fine structure constant. Now, these are other constants that we derive, that we can derive apparently the speed of light from. Now, as to figuring out those other constants, I don't think we can or we have yet. So,
let me hit what I think is the source of Greg's confusion here. He's thinking in a classical universe, right? He's thinking about speed, you know, and light having a maximum speed. And he's framing his question as if in a classical universe. But we don't live in a classical universe. We live in a relativistic universe where the speed of light is a constant, and it's not due to any sort of limitation or something. It's actually a fundamental property of our universe. It's just the way our universe is built. That's again what Einstein figured out. It's not just a fudge or a practical thing. It's actually a fundamental law of the universe that you could then build upon to derive other things about the universe.
So the answer is there is no answer to why the speed of light is the speed of light and why that happens to be the maximum velocity that anything could possibly move.
Well, if you then go to other things, then you could bring in, well, as if anything with mass, as it approaches the speed of light, its mass increases. And since nothing could have infinite mass, nothing with mass could be going at the speed of light.
Right. But I don't think that's related to his question.
Yeah, but I don't think that's what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Question number two, does the theory of dark matter have something to do with it?
No. Three?
Nope.
Yeah, so pretty much...
Yeah, pretty much no.
Dark matter is independent of the speed of light, so I can't think of any connection.
And we know so much, so little about dark matter anyway that...
Yeah. I mean, dark matter has to do with gravity, if anything.
Right.
We know it's there because it exerts gravity on regular matter, but it doesn't interact with regular matter much in any other way. And it's dark because it doesn't put out any light. We only know it's there by its gravitational effect on regular matter that we can see.
And that the universe is comprised of about 23%?
23% dark matter? Right. The universe is 4% regular matter, 23% dark matter, and 73% dark energy. Question number three, can the universe expand faster than the speed of light since it's expanding into nothing?
Absolutely.
Sort of.
But the nothing thing is a little, I'm not sure. The question seems like that since the universe is expanding into nothing, therefore it's like the brakes are off and it can go faster than the speed of light. I don't think that the fact that the universe can expand faster than light has anything to do with the fact that of what it may or may not be expanding into. And I think the general consensus is that it's not really expanding into anything. But absolutely, it's just a matter of the amount of intervening space between two objects, and the more space between two objects, and therefore the faster spaces, the faster these two objects are receding from each other because there's so much space in between them that each little bit of space that happens to be expanding just adds up and adds up, and you could have a velocity that exceeds the speed of light, and which doesn't break any laws because it's space, where space time we're talking about. It's not two objects in an object in local space traveling faster than the speed of light. So it's different. So yeah, that's not a problem, and it actually leads to a very very bleak, deep future for any life that may exist in billions or trillions of years, because eventually
all fades away. Yeah.
All stars and galaxies will dip behind the horizon, and we won't see anything beyond what's left of the local group of galaxies that we're in right now.
Yeah, they'll basically be inside one huge elliptical galaxy, which is what will remain after all of the galaxies in our local group crash into each other.
Right.
The final question is a tough one.
Yeah, this is the toughest one yet.
When are you visiting us down under?
When are we visiting?
I can't wait. I would love to go down there.
Oh my gosh!
Didn't we talk about this a couple weeks ago?
We definitely have. Every time it comes
vague
up,
plans
please,
to visit
people
to visit Australia and New Zealand.
Australia needs to have a bake sale, okay, and fly us down there.
Well, let's put it this way: we are definitely going to go to Australia and have a skeptical meeting of some kind, or you know, attend one that's there. It's just a matter of planning it, getting the funds, you know, and making the whole thing work logistically.
Right. But it'll happen as soon as we can logistically make it happen. We'll definitely all want to go.
Oh yeah,
no doubt about it.
We have a name that logical fallacy this week.
We do,
and this is a doozy of a name that logical fallacy. a gentleman by the name of Alexander Kornswald, who writes a blog, a conservative Christian blog, did a review of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Mm.
And many of our listeners shared their thoughts with him in the comments section of his review.
I'm sure he found that very helpful, by the way. Thank you to all of you.
So I can't read the whole thing, but I'll read certain sections.
Just the porny ones.
After some intro, he writes, "The SGU bills itself as an analytical podcast. They claim to be skeptical of any and all claims made by just about anyone. There are, of course, exceptions. The hosts pretty much accept global warming as gospel truth, and they're all unapologetic atheists. They go so far as to routinely ridicule Christians for having religious beliefs."
Boy.
He's just making crap up, basically. He clearly has an agenda. I mean, if you read his website and his blog entries, he has a fairly extreme view of things. First of all, we're a science podcast. Yes, we try to teach critical thinking and analytical thinking, if you will. Skeptical of all claims. Well, in that we apply the rules of skepticism and science to any and all claims in a fair and equal manner. Sure, I don't think that's what he meant. I think he means that we don't believe anything, which science is not about belief. It's just about what does the evidence and logic say. Then they say that we accept global warming as gospel truth. Well. I believe our statements were that here is this is what is the stated scientific consensus on the matter, not that it's beyond reproach or beyond scientific criticism or doubt. But they say that he also says that we routinely ridicule Christians. In fact, we never ridicule faith. We don't discuss faith per se. We only discuss scientific claims made by whoever, often sometimes in the name of a particular ideology or faith, but we only ever address scientific claims.
Right.
So those statements are just flat out wrong.
Oh, but it gets better, Steve.
It gets a lot better.
He just goes on.
He says the podcast is as anti-Christian as they come. This is just patently not true. Even if you set aside the wholesale endorsement of vaccination, their wholesale rejection of homeopathy, and their complete lack of regard for anything supernatural, and their unthinking acceptance of all things humanist, there's still their constant ridicule of Christ and his followers.
Yeah, I don't remember the last time we made fun of Christ or his followers. I don't remember the last time that anti-vaccination belief and homeopathy were Christian. Since when are those Christian concepts?
Yeah, right. But they are in his eyes, because this is if you read more of his blog, you understand the brand of his Christianity is that illness is sin. And if you treat illness, then you are subverting God's lesson to you. You should treat illness by praying to God for forgiveness. Vaccines are therefore an abomination to God. That's where he's coming from. But it's interesting, and what I couldn't find a specific entry on this, is then why isn't homeopathy in the same boat? I mean, apparently there are some complex rules about what kind of treatments are acceptable and which ones aren't. Is that because homeopathy is not real? Is that why they can use it? But that's kind of odd. I think that there's some kind of a Christian Science acceptance of homeopathy for some reason, but he apparently is a Baptist. I don't think that he's a Christian Scientist.
There's one line here that I have to read. There's nothing redeemable in this podcast. It's a propaganda mouthpiece for Satan and his followers.
That's 100% true.
Well, here, this is really where the logical fallacy comes in. He says, this is his logic, and when called on this, he says that if you're either for God or against God, and if you're not for God, then again, you must be against him. And if you're against God, you're for Satan.
False dichotomy.
And if you're for Satan, you listen to the podcast, and there's the link.
Well, he says, so we don't profess to believe in God, therefore we're Satanists. Right, so that's...
It's nice to live in a black and white world like
this. Pretty blatant sort of false dichotomy.
Yeah, we don't believe in Satan either, so where does that leave us?
No, but the thing is, Rebecca, if you don't believe in Satan, you could still be doing Satan's work.
Yeah, that's true.
Right,
but, how come it doesn't work the other way? How come if I don't believe in Satan, therefore I must be against Satan and for God? Why doesn't that work?
Ah,
Is he saying that there's broken symmetry in the whole God-Satan thing?
Ooh,
could be.
Nice one.
And if he's the anti-us, then we should never, ever, ever get near enough to touch him.
That's right.
He feels sorry for us, it says here.
typically getting critiques like this, this is actually very, it's funny and entertaining in a way, but he dipped into something that pissed me off, where he, in a way, mocked George Rabb's song about his dog that died. In a way, he basically said, the best thing that a quote-unquote atheist could say to another atheist is that the deceased won't have to miss me. And that, and that really pissed me off, not only because that was a very intimate moment that we had with him, and it really affected me at the time because I was going through a rough time in my personal life, which I think was obvious from listening. If that's one of the shows he listened to, it was obvious that that's what was going on.
Yeah, and everybody cried at the end, so yeah, I think the emotion kind of came through.
But, his point is that when you believe in God, you actually have something worthwhile to say to somebody when about a death, which is basically don't worry about it because everyone goes to heaven, which is, in my opinion, a fantasy.
Yeah, and actually, I don't know that he was saying that you have something worthwhile to say to them. I think what he's saying is that you have something comforting to say to them, which to me is just insulting that he admits that he would rather be comforted by something that he's willing to accept as true with absolutely no evidence, rather than dealing with reality, with the fact that, even if you're a Christian, you don't know. You don't know for sure what's going to happen. Nobody knows what's going to happen after we die. And that's really scary. And it takes a lot of courage to admit that you don't know and to live with that.
And that, by the way, is a logical fallacy of the argument from Final Consequences, which is that he's right because it has some practical value for him. Now, there's also a huge hypocrisy in this. The whole point of his blog entry is to essentially say that we are intolerant of people who believe, specifically of Christians, and that we ridicule faith, both of which are untrue. But then what he does is then ridicule us for our worldview, our faith, or lack thereof. He does exactly what he accuses us falsely of doing. His last sentence, despite everything these people are doing to drag souls to hell, I can't help but pity such lost, hopeless, pathetic creatures. Wow. So that's how he feels about our worldview. Obviously, it's grotesquely self-righteous what he's saying, but it's just being intolerant of a different faith, worldview, agnostic, atheist, or whatever, and which is what he's on about criticizing. So that is inconsistent rules, or more simply put, complete hypocrisy.
I'd just like to point out that we don't drag souls to hell. They come along quite freely.
Yeah.
You push them.
They're all in the back of the bus, drinking.
We can't drag souls to hell until we're there ourselves. Until we get there ourselves, we can only push them to hell.
Well, I'm definitely adding to my rolling list of titles an agent of Satan. That's going to stick.
And we do need to change the intro to the show. We'll have to change it. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, Mouthpiece of Satan.
Now, in his response to Rebecca's blog about this, he goes off on the separation of church and state thing.
Which I think that he has no clue. And
yeah,
it's so sad
no
that this continues to come up. Just Google it. Just Google it, and get a primer on why separation of church and state is an important thing and why it is a real thing that, our government is based on, that our society is based on.
This is a question where you could decide whether you think the separation of church and state is a good thing or not. That's a value judgment. But the historical question about the intention of the founding fathers is something for which evidence can be brought to bear.
Yeah. I mean, their point is always you can't find the word separation of church and state in the Constitution. No. But the fact that you can't find those exact words in that order does not mean that it's not an idea woven into the very fabric of the Constitution. Just read the friggin' thing. It's kind of important.
Well, he brings up that point, and which, of course, you say it's true. I mean, they didn't use those words in the Constitution, but they you know, said Congress shall make no laws respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The intention of that is pretty clear. And if it weren't clear from the Constitution itself, there are documents by the Founding Fathers that make it absolutely clear. There, of course, there's the letter to the Danbury Baptists by Thomas Jefferson, where he actually coins the phrase separation of church and state, or he uses it. I don't know if that was the first instance of it. So that those words come from Thomas Jefferson. And then there was the big thing was the Treaty of Tripoli, which is a document. It was, you know, a treaty in, signed into law, so it has the binding force of law in this country that spells out in no uncertain terms the separation of church and state.
Yeah.
So now he falls on the thing. Okay, well that only applies to the federal government and not the states, which of course then contradicts all of his previous arguments, but we'll put that aside. So this is like the Kettle defense, where you make mutually exclusive arguments. But I believe we fought a civil war over that, if I recall, over the states' rights versus the federal versus the Constitution. We also have 100 years plus of judicial precedents saying that, oh yeah, the states do have to abide by the Constitution and specifically separation of church and state. So every one of his arguments is demonstrably false, demonstrably false. But you know, this is the kind of person you don't want to confuse with the facts. Well, we had a lot of fun with this guy.
Oh yeah.
I hope he had as much.
No.
If not more. Probably not.
He takes himself far too seriously. Well, let's go on to our interview. Sitting with us now is PZ Myers. PZ, welcome back to the Skeptics Guide.
Glad to be back.
And PZ is the author of the popular science blog Pharyngula. And was one of the scientists who was featured in the film Expelled. That's what we talked to you about largely when you were on our show last time. Can you give us the update on how Expelled is going as a project, as a movie?
Well, it's kind of fading fast. It's dropped out of most theaters in the United States. Rumor has it, the estimates are it made about $7 million, which is okay, but probably not as much as they spent on advertising. And now it's opening in Canada. I hear they're opening 50 theaters.
Mm-hmm. 50.
Yeah. 50, yes.
And, oh, boy.
Next week it will be zero, but yeah. Something along those lines.
What about DVD sales? Wasn't there something that might have actually prevented DVD sales?
There was the bizarre Yoko Ono lawsuit where it was further distribution was temporarily held up because Yoko Ono was upset that they used Imagine in the movie. That's been cleared up now. They've been given a go-ahead. They're probably going to come out with DVDs in the fall. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'll get one.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I might rent one from the local video store because I haven't seen it yet.
I haven't either.
It's kind of funny, isn't it, to be actively campaigning against a movie you're in and to not even get a chance to see
yeah.
It.
No, I visited my mother last week and I had to break the news to her that I was a movie star, but the movie sucked.
Or you could spin it and say, I'm the best thing in that movie.
Oh, well, I did tell her that, of course. But, you know, I've got, 30 seconds in the movie, so it's not enough to pull the weight of the whole show.
That's true.
So for those two listeners who don't know what we're talking about, Expelled is a propaganda movie against evolution put out by the Intelligent Design folks. Not created by the Discovery Institute, but certainly supported by them. And it has been a dismal failure on all levels. So to summarize, it lost money. And it was pretty much only appreciated by the already converted. So it didn't convert anybody. It didn't really accomplish any goal that they might have had for it.
Yeah, even there, I don't think it did so well with the already converted. It's a strange hybrid movie where the built-in audience for it is evangelical Christians, right? But they put on these ads where it's all talking about rebelliousness and Ben Stein in short pants is going to turn everyone off anyway.
It haunts my dreams.
Yeah, and I just don't think it even built an audience there. And then they did silly things like spend a huge amount of money advertising on The Daily Show.
That's right.
The Daily Show audience is not their audience. That was money they threw away.
Yeah, although, wow.
Good.
It looked impressive, but did nothing for their bottom line.
Yeah, sounds like they were pretty clueless at every level.
Every step of the way, yeah.
Good. PZ, what are you going to be talking to us during your lecture at TAM?
I hope I'm going to be a little bit going against type. Because people always expect me to show up and start breathing fire, and I'm not going to. I'm actually going to show some really pretty stuff. Just here's some really cool science that's coming out now, and I'm going to be showing some of these nice time-lapse videos that I've made in the lab, and I'm going to tell people how important developmental biology is.
Mm-hmm.
So
I heard a rumor that you were doing a dance number too. Is that true?
And with singing, yes.
Yeah, good. Yes.
Then he's going to cuddle a kitten for half an hour on stage.
Well, I know I missed the last interview that everyone else did with you, but I just wanted to say I loved you breaking into that phone conference. I loved that so much. That was incredible.
I just listened. I was there the entire time, but I just listened quietly until near the end when I broke in. And,
yeah. Right.
Just couldn't take it anymore. Yeah. And to catch people up, if they're not aware, the Expelled producers had what was supposedly a teleconference for members of the press. I put that in scare quotes. And nobody was allowed to speak on the conference except for the Expelled producers and Ben Stein and PZ.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. The whole premise is ridiculous. I mean, why have a press conference where you're not going to take any questions?
Right.
I mean, it's so ironic, but revealing as well, that here the whole premise of the movie is open academic freedom and open inquiry and all that stuff, which is BS.
Right.
And then they really reveal that they don't really give a rat's ass about academic freedom. And the whole way they conduct the film, they lied to everybody who they filmed about it. And then during their press conferences, they're maniacally controlling the flow of information. You can't even ask questions openly of them. So they maximally control and distort information, and yet it's supposed to be about freedom of information. It's ridiculous.
Right. But they are actually having a little bit of success there. I mean, because we've got that new bill in Louisiana, for instance, that's basically what it is. It's a law that says, okay, we're going to support academic freedom by telling teachers that they can just say whatever crap they want to teach to their students anytime.
Wow. That's not good.
No, I think you're right, though. I think that framing this is like the next phase now. We were wondering, where are they going to go after trying to insert intelligent design and trying to insert criticism of evolution? And now they found the next bit, which is academic freedom, which unfortunately
– tougher to fight.
It's tough because it's –
it sounds attractive.
Attractive. In America, you attach the word freedom to whatever you're trying to push, and it works.
Yes, they're using the buzzwords effectively. But what it really is, it isn't about academic freedom at all. It's actually about stripping away academic standards. It's about saying, we're not going to impose any kind of regulation on the quality control, on the good stuff that should be taught in the classroom. And in the name of this fiction of academic freedom, we're going to remove all those requirements. So, the states are supposed to have these things called state science standards, where they get together these committees that decide, well, here's the state of the art right now. Here's what our children ought to be coming out of their high school knowing. And they're usually fairly simple and straightforward, and they're not as in-depth as I would like them to be. But they say things like, you ought to know basic principles of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you ought to be teaching. And this is a law that basically says, no, you don't have to do that anymore. You can ignore the stringent requirements, and stringent is in air quotes, that they impose on their teachers.
So what's the counter message? How do we counteract this?
Well, I think the way we have to counter it is we have to focus on quality education, that we have to say that, if you want your student to grow up and be something other than a ditch digger, you got to get some education and you got to teach them stuff. So I think to the public, we have to frame it as an issue of good education standards.
So this is an attack on good education.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
On Sunday, I'm going off to the Evolution 2008 meetings, and this is what I'm going to be talking about there. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be talking to a group of scientists and educators. This is the special education session of the Evolution meetings. And that's going to be my message to them, is that we have to start getting very active and going in there. And we've got to help out high school teachers. We've got to do things like volunteer to work at the high schools and cover their butts when parents come in and scream at them. We have to take our students and we have to start right from the ground up, and we have to teach them basic things like, what is science? What is the philosophy of science? How does science work? How do we know all these things that we're teaching you as facts? Because we're getting an awful lot of students right now that don't know this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I've been teaching for almost 20 years now. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Almost 20 years. And, you know, I've noticed this gradual shift in the student population. It's not so much that the students are getting dumber. They're not. That we still always have these quality students who come in. They've been well educated in their high schools. They know their stuff. But we're seeing more and more increasing numbers of these students who come in, think they're going into a biology program, think they're going to be doctors, and they don't know crap. They mm-hmm. don't know anything. They've been lied to and misled to by their teachers for years and years. And suddenly I find myself in my introductory biology courses faced with this horrible dilemma that I've got the student body that's mixed, that there are students who are ready to learn, mm-hmm. and then there's this whole body of students that need a lot of remedial work to bring them up to speed. That's been an increasing difficulty in the classroom.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Any way to sort them out and like have a remedial biology class for those who need it?
That's a problem.
I know some universities sometimes are doing that with other basic skills, yeah. like where high schools are giving them students who don't have basic reading and writing skills, so they get them up to speed, and maybe we need to do the same thing in science.
Well, yeah, it would be a nice thing to be able to do, but the way the biological curriculum right now is packed to the gills and overflowing. We have got to cram so much stuff into those, you know, that magic limit of 4 years. Mm-hmm. You can't tell parents, well, if you send your son here, they will graduate in 5 years because they'll just be adding up the dollar signs. Mm-hmm. So we've got to get it done in 4 years. And doing things like taking a student aside and saying, you know what, you're not ready for our first year curriculum. You've got to get this background done. Nobody would like that at all. We would... Mm-hmm. You know, public school teachers get the angry parents coming in and yelling at them about don't teach them sex ed or don't teach them evolution. We get angry parents coming in yelling, you're costing me tuition money. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty effective argument.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's hard to squeeze a remedial course in there. I mean, every once in a while I've done it. I've managed to talk a student into saying, you know, you've got a choice. You can either go back and get some remedial work done and get the background so that your grades don't suck. Mm-hmm. Or you can charge ahead and get C's and D's and forget about getting into medical school.
Right.
When you frame it like that, that kind of puts things into perspective for them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. An extra year of undergraduate education is a lot cheaper than med school. Mm-hmm.
What about not accepting these kids? To say, you're coming from this school? Sorry, we're not even going to look at your application.
Yeah.
That's probably not practical or feasible, but I mean, that would send a message to the lower schools. Hey, we got to get on board if we want them to go to these good schools.
Yeah. And, you know, I go through this every once in a while where I'm thinking, you know, like right now I'm thinking, let's just write off Louisiana and say, forget it. You apply to us from the Louisiana school and you're not getting in. However, you know, it's not fair that the people being victimized are the students.
Yeah. Right?
That would be compounding the victimization of those students to be telling them that because your teachers have failed you and because your parents are screw-offs and because your politicians are raving lunatics, we're going to inflict a little further punishment on you.
Yeah.
This mm-hmm. this is your life. You're going down the tubes right now, and we're flushing the handle. So, yeah, I don't want to take that step.
So how do you send the message to those schools?
That's a tough one. We don't want to do it by punishing the students, first of all. Okay, that's off the table. But on the other hand, you know, we can send a fairly objective message that, you know, we have standards for admission. You've got to get these kinds of scores on your SATs or your ACT exams or whatever. And we can hammer it home to the high school teachers that if they don't have X, Y, and Z, they're not going to perform well enough to get into our school. And then they'll just say, well, then we'll send them off to Bible school or something. Right. But, you know,
well, who controls the SAT tests, like those, that level of testing? Because could this actually one day affect those tests? Maybe they'll ask questions that aren't even up to standards anymore.
No, standardized testing is kind of a mess as it is. That what you often find is the things you need to know to do well on a standardized test like the SATs or the MCATs or whatever are tens of thousands of little facts piled on facts piled on facts. So they're not really testing general knowledge very well at all. You can have a student who is a creationist. I've actually had students like this who don't accept evolution at all and believe in a 6,000-year-old Earth, and they're able to go through the MCAT, you know, practice books and get their scores up and get into medical school.
Right.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about, you bring up the fact that you've had creationist students, and there is a bit of a controversy, mainly in the blogs that we, the various blogs, about whether or not students can and should be graded on what they believe as opposed to what they know. Where do you fall on that debate?
You can't test them on what they believe, and you can't demand that they believe something. That's unethical, and it's impractical for another mm-hmm. thing. What I try to do in my classroom is, well, first of all, the first day of classes, I have to have this little disclaimer. I actually stand up there for 10 minutes and explain to them that if they go on the web and look up my name, they might be horrified to discover that I'm this raving liberal, godless, horrible human being. Then I have to tell them that, no, you're not going to be graded on your adherence to atheism and so forth. But what I try to do in the classroom then is try to foster an atmosphere where they can feel free to ask questions. Mm-hmm. That if you've got a creationist in the classroom, you don't slap them around, you don't tell them that's a stupid question, go sit down in the back or anything like that. You encourage them to ask these questions, and then you answer them. Mm-hmm. I think that's the only way right. to do it is drag them out of the darkness and into right. the light and have them ask these questions so that you can actually address the issues that are troubling them. I don't expect to persuade any of them.
Have you?
I have, but it's not like I get these instant conversions where they say, "Oh, well, I'm an atheist now," it's nothing like that. But it's like, okay, I can understand the evidence now, and mm-hmm. I will accept that interpretation of the evidence, at least for the purposes of the class and so forth. So, at least they know that it's not, that we don't push evolution on them because it's the evil atheist conspiracy saying mm-hmm. we've got this doctrine you have to adhere to. No, this is the logical conclusion from a whole lot of evidence that we give them in class. So, for instance, in my introductory biology class, I took this big step this year. One of the books I use is Mark Isaac's book, The Counter-Creationism Handbook. I don't know if you know that book. You've got to get it if you're ever dealing with creationists. Mm-hmm. There's a Talk Origins page that's a bunch of what is it called? Well, if you go on a Talk Origins, you can't miss it. It's this page. It's a whole bunch of creationist fallacies with the answers, and this has now been published in this nice thick book.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
And it's the most useful tool I've got for dealing with creationists because it covers everything. I'm a biologist, so I don't know much geology, I don't know much astrophysics, etc. But when I get into a debate with a creationist, this is the common tactic: is you start arguing about genetics, for instance, and then they just go, "Oh, well, he teaches genetics." Well, then I'll switch to geology, and they'll start hammering it. But then you can pull out this book and you can flip to the section on geology and. Really, creationists are the most unoriginal people on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You look at what they're saying, and it's the same old stuff over and over. And so all the answers are right there. Mm-hmm. And it gets very intimidating to them after a while that, you keep on flipping this magic book, and there's this reply with citations and all this kind of stuff. And the best situation is when they give up and they say, "Okay, can I have the book?"
Yeah.
And they sit there thumbing through it and discover that, mm-hmm. wow. We really have got that covered.
Well, PZ, thank you so much for sitting with us. We're all looking forward to your presentation, and maybe we'll get a chance to talk to you again a little bit later.
Yes, be happy to.
Thanks, PZ.
Thanks, PZ.
Okay. Thanks.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake. And my panel of skeptics tries to figure out which one is the fake.
Not always successfully.
Is everyone ready? I did get you all last
week.
We're
ready.
We'll see how you do this
week. We will best you this time.
Avenge.
Here we go. Item number 1. Scientists develop a special thermometer, quick and durable enough to measure the temperature during an explosion. Item number 2. New research shows that people who score highest on measures of sociopathic behavior are more likely to assume leadership positions. And item number 3. Scientists discover a new protein that is 8 times as effective as morphine at relieving pain. And Jay, why don't you go first?
Okay. The first one, scientists develop a special thermometer, quick and durable enough to measure the temperature during an explosion. That's really cool. I don't doubt that. New research shows that people who score highest on measures of sociopathic behavior are more likely to assume leadership positions. Wow. Well, that is right now. That's a funny thing to be thinking, considering, isn't it? With the upcoming election and the last one, scientists discover a new protein that is 8 times as effective as morphine at relieving pain. I hate ones like this because, you know, Steve could be like, no, it's only 7 times more effective.
Yeah, but I've never cut it that thin, right? You know
yeah, but
that.
I know, but we've got a bust on you on that. It's difficult. It's very difficult. Wow, I am stumped. Okay, I will say that number two, the research that shows that people who score the highest on sociopathic behavior are more likely to assume leadership positions is wrong.
Okay, Bob.
All right, the sociopathic behavior and leadership, I'm going to go along with that one. That sounds possible, that certain aspects of people's personalities that make them a little sociopathic could make them better leader, possibly. The thermometer that's durable and quick enough, that's something that doesn't sound right about that. But it seems plausible that you could make a thermometer that could withstand certain types of explosions. Let's see. The morphine, a morphine-like pain reliever that's 8 times as effective. Wow, that would be quite a discovery, but that sounds like a lot. All right. I'm going to say the thermometer is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Well, crap. I think that the thermometer is true. That can happen. I'm really torn between...
Two lovers?
The sociopathic behavior, yes, and the morphine one. I like the idea of sociopaths being more likely to assume leadership positions. It kind of makes sense when I consider all the sociopathic bosses I've had in the past, but that could just be to mislead me. As for the morphine, the protein that's 8 times as effective as morphine. So I'm going to say that sociopathic behavior is not more likely to make you choose leadership positions.
Okay, Evan?
Fiction.
Oh, boy. Well, I'll get right to it. The new protein, 8 times as effective as morphine. All right, so as relieving pain. Well, pain's pretty subjective, right? And imagine... pain being the subjective animal that it is, the effect of morphine it has on relieving pain can also be subjective. And how the fact that you discover a new protein 8 times as effective, how did you get that measurement? How were you able to put such a hard number on something that is, I think, innately not subject to numbers? So I smell a rat there, and that's the one I think is fiction.
Okay, so you guys are spread all over the map today.
Oh, yeah.
So you haven't gotten us all.
I prefer this better, actually. This means they were well-balanced. So I'll just take them in order then, I guess, since you guys are all over the place. Number one, scientists develop a special thermometer quick and durable enough to measure the temperature during an explosion. And who said that one was fiction, Bob?
Yeah. Bob said it was fiction.
Bob.
That one is science.
Ha.
Boom.
I mean,
scientists designed bomb-proof thermometer. Really cool. I mean, this thing can measure temperatures 50,000 times a second. So that's how fast it can respond. And therefore, it could give you a 1/50,000th of a second of time in terms of what the temperature was during that right during the explosion. It's calibrated up to 3,000 Kelvin. And I'll take this opportunity to point out that, and I think a couple of weeks ago I said something degrees Kelvin. I think we're talking about the LHC, and many listeners pointed out that with Kelvin it's not degrees, it's just Kelvin. So 3,000 Kelvin or 2,727 degrees Celsius. At any rate, it could measure and it could survive the explosion. It could survive it. So it's durable enough, fast enough, and can measure a high enough temperature to actually give us the temperature of an explosion as it's happening. Pretty cool. Number two, new research shows that people who score highest on measures of sociopathic behavior are more likely to assume leadership positions. And Jay and Rebecca thought that this one was the fiction.
Yes.
And this one is the fiction.
Ah. Well, ha-ha! Done. Wieners.
I hate that, man. I hate that. I saw an article. I mean, I didn't get too deep into it, but it had to do with narcissistic people.
Yeah, narcissism is not sociopathic behavior. So
that's not. It's not sociopathic at all. Being
no. So this is the study was that people who scored highly and as on measures of narcissism. So narcissistic people are most likely to emerge as leaders. Narcissism is thinking very highly of yourself, being focused on yourself. Whereas sociopathic behavior is...
I know. Yeah, I know what it means, but I...
Having no empathy and being able to do horrible things to other people.
I thought that you could somehow...
They're not interchangeable. Narcissistic and sociopathic are not interchangeable.
Not interchangeable, but if you broaden, narcissism could be considered a form of sociopathic behavior. So that's why I thought you just changed
it. They're just different. They're completely separate. In the DSM-4R, whatever we are up to... They're completely different personality types.
All right.
They're distinct. So, yeah, I figured I might catch somebody on that.
And it was Bob.
If you
again
read the headline but didn't, or you just remembered it slightly off. But it's very interesting, and it does make sense that, in order to assume a leadership position that you have to think rather highly of yourself. So it kind of makes sense. Which means that scientists discover a new protein that is 8 times as effective as morphine at relieving pain is science. And this is... extremely cool. I probably would have pegged this one as the fiction if I were handed these 3 items.
Thank you.
Because not for your reason, Evan. Your reason is not correct. In fact, we have measures of pain that are pain scales that are quantifiable. There, for example, is an analog pain scale where you, or even a digital pain scale where you say 1 to 10, rate your pain from 1 to 10. You give a number, and that's the number. Yes, it's subjective, but you still translate it into a number so that you can then
average
make numerical. Yeah, you can make numerical comparisons between one thing and another. So here's the thing: there's only so many targets for drugs to act upon. And when we think of drugs, we think about the targets they act upon primarily, right? So morphine-like drugs, narcotics, bind to opiate receptors. And any drug that binds to an opiate receptor is an opiate. It's kind of defined by what it binds to and what it's and how that changes the physiology of the target cells, in this case, inhibiting the conduction of pain. Aspirin-like drugs are... inhibit cyclooxygenase, which is involved in, pain transmission or generation. There's only so many different ways you can interfere with the process of pain forming and being transmitted. One of the biggest, in fact, limitations of our ability to treat pain is that we only have a couple of targets to go after. The big limitation for opiates is that the same receptors also, in addition to inhibiting pain, they also cause a very addictive euphoria. So they're extremely addictive drugs. And they also suppress respiration. So if you're really treating very severe pain, and this is why when the heroin addicts die with the needle in their arm. You see that a lot in movies, right? They find the heroin addict with the needle in their arm. That's because if you overdose, you stop breathing. That's what kills you. So this discovery is very exciting because there are scientists at Chapel Hill, this is the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and also the University of Helsinki, discovered a totally new target for pain control. That's what's exciting. It's not so much the drug itself, it's the new target, a new way of interfering with the conduction of pain. The limitation of the protein that they have that does it is that it's a protein. Now, proteins, although they can be used as drugs, they don't make very good drugs because you can't eat them. Yeah. If you eat a protein, it just gets broken down into amino acids in your stomach, and then it's not a protein anymore. It's just food. It's amino acids. What we currently have could be used as an intravenous form of pain medication. What has to, of course, go through the whole FDA process. Now, what the pharmaceutical companies, I'm sure, are going to want to do is develop a molecule that mimics the effects of the proteins, of this protein, like that. That's a small molecule that is in a stable form that can be absorbed through the gut and have reasonable half-life. All the properties that we like drugs to have. Pharmacologically to make them useful. One other interesting thing about this mechanism is that this protein actually shuts off pain production for several days, which is very useful to have an incredibly long-acting effect like that, whereas morphine typically just hangs out for a few hours. Yeah, a few days. That would be nice.
But what kind of pain, though, Steve?
Yeah, what kind of pain relief does it provide?
Are you immune to pain for 3 days?
Well, I mean, these are really only done in animals at this point in time, so it's hard to say. But, I mean, it looks like it's more, you know, more effective than morphine. Morphine actually isn't what we would call a ceiling effect on morphine. So, like, aspirin-like drugs have a ceiling effect, meaning that once you get to a certain maximum dose, that's all the effect you're going to get. And no matter how much higher you go up on the dose past that point, you get no more pain-relieving effect. Opiates do not have a ceiling of effect. You can get more pain relief out of higher doses without limit. The limitation is the side effects. It's the fact that it makes you unconscious and stop breathing and things like that. That's the limitation on it. I you know, it's hard to say this is very new and preliminary, but from my reading so far, it seems like this does not have a ceiling effect, that it's 8 times as potent as morphine, and it lasts a lot longer. But it will remain to be seen in specific pharmacological preparations, you know, how much clinical effect we can get out of it. And of course, then you have to make sure there's no side effects and et cetera, et cetera. So this is, you know, at the animal basic science level of research. But again, what's really exciting is that we have a new target, which has the potential of creating a whole new class of pain medications, which is sorely needed because we have very limited choices, really, when it comes to pain control. Yeah. So good job, Jay and Rebecca.
Thank you.
Fantastic.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
This week's quote is by Henri Poincaré. I've quoted him before, and this one was sent in by a listener named Tristan Zimmerman. And the quote is, "The scientist does not study nature because it is useful. He studies it because he delights in it. And he delights in it because it is beautiful." Henri Poincaré!
That's definitely very apropos for a physicist. Because as we were discussing earlier with the whole symmetry thing, you know, there is a certain amount of beauty to the, you know, theoretical physics and describing all the different particles and the forces and the way it all works together. Theoretical physicists in particular love elegance and beauty in their models of nature.
Skeptics in the Pub News, yay! We have Sid Rodriguez coming to Boston Skeptics in the Pub on Monday, October 20th, 7 o'clock, Tommy Doyle's, bostonskeptics.com. And while I'm talking about Skeptics in the Pub, I meant to mention this a while back, but Simon Perry wrote into us with a very sweet letter that I'm going to read right now because it's very nice. He says, "I really enjoy the show and wanted you to know that you seem to be having a really positive effect. I run a group called Skeptics in the Pub in, I think it's pronounced Leicester, England, and we've had at least 3 or 4 people who have attended after listening to your show. From what they tell me, it seems you're not just preaching to the converted, but you are actually bringing people into skepticism. So thank you, Simon, and I hope other people go and check out Leicester Skeptics in the Pub. You can find it at leicester.skepticsinthepub.org, and Leicester is spelled L-E-I-C-E-S-T-E-R, and I probably said it wrong. So,
yep, bringing people into skepticism or dragging souls to hell, depending on your perspective.
Kicking and screaming.
Both very important.
Yes.
Same podcast, 2 distinct views. Fascinating.
Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
It was
a lot
Thanks,
of fun.
Steve.
And probably as you're listening to this, if you're picking this up on Saturday, we are at our live event. Mm-hmm. And next week's podcast will be the recording from the live event that we're doing on the 11th.
I wonder if we're having fun.
I hope so. I hope we're having fun right now.
Here, we're waving to you from the show right now.
Oh. Weird.
You get a bunch of skeptics in a room, we always have a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
Totally.
Well, until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.